ANC has ruled South Africa for 3 decades, during which time the country has gone from the promise of the Rainbow Nation to dysfunction and despair. In The Supercaders, best-selling author Peter du Toit examines this legacy from the early days through to the disappointment of the Ramaphosa presidency. Du Toit asks key questions before coming to a critical observation and a damning conclusion. What was the state of the ANC when it took power? Was ANC failure inevitable? Did they inherit a country so stricken by apartheid that success was impossible? When did the first signs of misrule and corruption occur? In this episode of PageCast, Peter is in conversation with Cape Talk radio presenter John Matham. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm John Matham, and welcome to another Jonathan Ball Publishers PageCast. The book under discussion today is The Supercaders, ANC Misrule in the Age of Deployment by Peter du Toit, author also of The Stellenbosch Mafia. Peter, hello.
Hello, John. Good seeing you, and good to have a discussion with you.
I went down a bit of a rabbit hole this morning trying to establish what is the correct pronunciation of this word, C-A-D-R-E, and let's say the way we talk about it here in South Africa as K-D, as CADA, is not acceptable around the world. But hey, that's the word we use, so that's the word we're going to use in this conversation. ANC Misrule in the Age of Deployment. And from your book, The Age of Deployment is from day one. I mean, it's not as if this is a new phenomenon. CADA deployment has been part of ANC policy, a fixed, avowed part of ANC policy for pretty much as long as the ANC has been in government. It hasn't worked for us. It hasn't worked for them.
John, you're right. It has certainly, most certainly not worked. And the premise of the book is around CADA deployment, and it is around the impact that the party policy of absolute state control, which they wanted to achieve with the deployment of party apparatchiks at all levels of the state, parastatals and agencies connected to the state. I argue that that's at the absolute center of the malaise that we've experienced over the last 10 to 15 years, John. You know, we if you look at all the metrics, unfortunately at the moment, they are negative. If you look at debt to GDP, unemployment, all the main stuff, GDP growth, it's because of poor policy. It's because of poor policy implementation. And it's because of a party that until recently was the governing party, or as they like to call themselves, the ruling party, that because of their, I do think their insatiable desire for political control made poor decisions, and that led to the proliferation of these networks of patronage and extraction, John. So it's a complicated story, and it was a difficult story to formulate and a difficult narrative to try and weave together. But CADA deployment, in a nutshell, I think is responsible for most of the issues that we are confronted with in South Africa in 2024.
I mean, essentially, the book is a record of the ANC's performance in government from 1994 up until the couple of months before this book ago, when the book went to the printers. Is there an argument to be made, Peter, for the necessity? I mean, we can agree that the way that CADA deployment has been used has been very negative for the country. But is there an argument to be made that given what happened, 1990, the unbanning of the ANC, 4 years plus of very difficult negotiations, an enormous amount of political violence, threats, and the real prospect at times following the execution of Chris Hani and others that things were going to collapse into kind of all-out civil war. But then the ANC comes into power. They are a grouping with no experience of governance at all. They're coming into a country which, in terms of its institutions, has been hostile to the ANC. Yes, they got a significant percentage of the vote, so the citizens, many of them, are behind the ANC. But the institutions are against. The institutions deeply rooted in a different way of doing things. Isn't there a case to be made for we actually have to get our own people in charge so we can drive the agenda, which the election told us is a very necessary agenda to be driven?
Yeah. Two parts to my answer to your two-part question. One, it is a record, I suppose, of the ANC's performance over the last 30 years, because I do think that as we move into an era of fractured coalition politics, a GNU, it is necessary to remember and understand again how we came to the point where we are. It's no use only looking at the years of state capture without considering what became before that, and even what became before the years of democracy, because all of these eras flow into each other and are interconnected. So we, you know, you can't judge the state capture era in isolation. So that's the first thing. But secondly, of course, there's a strong argument to be made, which was forcefully made, and which is quite logical and completely acceptable, that once a political party wins an election, it obviously earns the right to make certain senior political appointments. That's how democracy works, and that's how it works the world over. I had a fascinating interview or two with Trevor Manuel, who's no shrinking violet, John, as you very well know. He's a very difficult individual, and he explained in quite colorful detail to me what he found at the Department of Trade and Industry when he became the head of, and now you must remember, Trevor Manuel came from the UDF environment on the Cape Flats. He is a 38-year-old colored man in the apartheid parlance that was then sent to the bureaucracy in deep Afrikaner, the hinterland of Pretoria, to take charge of a department where they only spoke Afrikaans, where, you know, the most high-ranking female official probably was a secretary. And in this environment, this colored guy from the Cape Flats had to try and lead a department. I mean, it was extraordinarily difficult. So, of course, they had to have the ability to appoint senior officials like your director general or a deputy director general or a chief of staff, given where the DA is at the moment, chiefs of staff, to try and change the culture of those departments. And Manuel explained to me that it wasn't only about changing individuals, but it was about changing the whole culture of the state machinery. And you're right. I mean, when Manuel went across to trade and industry in 1994, you know, Afrikaner bureaucrats who weeks before was still implementing apartheid policy was now reporting to someone that, you know, in the early 1990s couldn't even own a house in the ministerial enclave of Waterkloof. So yes, they had to appoint people, they had to get their people in because the country had to change. The state had to change. And the state is obviously the most important vehicle to affect broad societal change. So yes. But what KD deployment did, John, went much farther than that. And I think the problem that we are still sitting with, and I think the problem that the DA ministers in the current government of national unity is facing, is when your public service, your civil service, becomes politicized, when they aren't a professional civil service serving the government of the day, then you're going to run into problems. And I think what KD deployment did was fill up the whole of the public sector, the whole of the bureaucracy, with bureaucrats and civil servants whose loyalty was to the ANC first, to the ANC constitution first. And this led to a myriad of problems, of which the most important is obviously state capture, corruption, and patronage.
There are different countries do it in different ways. There are countries that have more independently minded civil services. I mean, they are civil service career, and as political parties in charge of governments in those countries change, the civil service remains the same. America is not like that. If Donald Trump wins the election on the 5th of November, then America's civil service is going to change, and people are in there either putatively neutral or Democrat supporting are going to be replaced by people who are diehard Trump loyalists. So I mean, it's not an issue that South Africa wrestles. I mean, we have our own particular consequences the way it has happened in our country in our recent history. But it is, you know, it's a global question.
I mean, there are literally thousands of federal government positions that need to be filled in the United States when there's a change of government. Those positions are advertised, people need to apply for them, and more often than not, you're right, you know, they are filled by Democrats when it's a Democratic president, and Republicans when it's vice versa. we inherited our civil service culture and convention from the British. After union was obtained in 1910, the civil service became a professional civil service. And that was the, you know, given the context of the time, obviously, where we are now, you know, you have to appreciate the context of the time. But the civil service was constructed on the British tradition of a professional civil service, independent of the political governors of the day. And I think the adage goes that the civil service serves every government with equal loyalty and equal contempt. So that was the ideal. Obviously, when the nationalists, and I write about this in Supercaders, John, when the nationalists took over in 1948, the biggest purge that occurred was in the Union Defence Force, because the Afrikaner nationalists did not want to have the Union Defence Force commanded by English-speaking professional soldiers. So that was where the biggest purge occurred. And then obviously, as after 1948, the Afrikaner Nationalist Project, you know, driven also by the Broederbond, who was also a form of deployment and also had their own deployment committee, used the state as a vehicle of employment for poor Afrikaners. And that also led to power abuse, led to patronage politics, led to corruption. And obviously, it led to the brutal system of apartheid that was enforced by the state. But I think after 1994, the wish and the idea, certainly, of the constitutional framers was that we need a professional civil service that serves the interests of the government of the day, but also whose loyalty is supposed to lie with the Constitution. And John, in 1997, the ANC had a national conference in Mafikeng, now called Mayikeng. Nelson Mandela was still head of state. Thabo Mbeki was starting to exert power in the party. And that's where the policy of cadre deployment was formalized by the party. It was later formalized in statute when the Public Sector Administration Act was amended under Mandela's presidency, which enabled the government, not the state, to make a myriad of senior appointments. And then cadre deployment became a theology, John, I argue in the book, for the ANC, because it was about complete political control for the party. It was about controlling all levers of power. And, you know, that's what they say in their policy documents. It's not made up. They in as many words in all the various policy documents that were formulated in the 1990s, certainly under Mbeki's leadership and someone like Joel Nechitenze's leadership, was about the ANC wanting to maintain absolute political control. And for that to happen, they had to control all levers of power at all levels of government and the state. It's nuanced, but there's a significant difference, I think, between, for example, what happens when there's a change of government in the United States and what's happened here since certainly 1997 and 1998, John.
Let's, you know, go back. 1994, the ANC is elected into power. They establish a government of national unity. We have an interim constitution, which takes some time to finalize. And there's a kind of apartheid ahistoricity, where people who have some form of nostalgia for apartheid believe that the apartheid era handed over to the ANC era a fully functional, well-resourced, properly invested country. It didn't. I mean, the Nats handed over to the ANC a kind of wasteland. And
it was a bankrupt state, John. It was a bankrupt state.
Yeah. And for a long time, it looked as if the ANC, with what it was doing, and it was improving. The indicators tell us that it was. Houses were being built. Yeah. Taps Absolutely. Were being connected. The budget was being brought yeah. under control, as you point yeah. out. We had a budget surplus to help cushion us yeah. through the worst of the impact of the global crisis, financial crisis, yes, in 2008. And of course, there are warning signs, and you identify yeah. all of them. Sarafina and what happened there, the refusal to accept Bantu Halomisa's description of Sela Sixao as corrupt for paying bribes to Saul Kersner, the AIDS, mm-hmm. Viridine issues. They're all there, but by yeah. and large, yeah. South Africa's on a positive trajectory. Yeah. And it's on yeah. a positive trajectory with a policy of cadre deployment in place.
Yeah.
So is it the polity or is it the people that are deployed as part of the policy that is the problem, or is it both equally?
Yeah. Great question, John. I think it's a mixture of both. As a point of departure, look, the ANC inherited a bankrupt state. The ANC inherited a state with enormous levels of debt, internal levels of debt. South Africa couldn't borrow on overseas markets. So the largest levels of debt, as Trevor Manuel explained it to me, was government debt. And that was owed to pension funds because there was prescribed assets was official government policy. So the ANC government in 1994 inherited a broken and corrupted state. One thing that we tend to forget, which was fascinating listening to Manuel in our conversation, was that they had to consolidate 9 different departments. For every department that existed, they had to consolidate all the TBVC states, all the self-governing territories. Every state, for example, had their own Department of Education. So that had to be consolidated into a national Department of Education. So the restructuring of the state and society was an enormous task. And the ANC, with enormous moral authority as well, John, set about its task to try and establish a coherent and functioning state and government, first of all. But also it had enormous moral authority to be able to do that. So there was enormous support for the ANC government in the early years. And I think only the most cynical of us would have been opposed to that. I think every single right-thinking South African wanted the ANC government to succeed. And I think certainly that was the zeitgeist of the moment in the mid-1990s. And the trajectory was good. When Trevor Manuel left Treasury in 2009, we had a budget surplus. We had unemployment at 22%. Debt-to-GDP ratio wasn't much worse than that. And things were looking good. And like you say, it happened whilst KD deployment was being implemented in that period. But what went wrong? It was a combination of the wrong individuals being deployed to certain positions. The most egregious example and something that we're sitting with today is Jacob Zuma, who became deputy president from the backwaters of KZN, where he was a lowly MEC for economic development. But he was a deeply problematic individual, as we well know. And there were many Jacob Zumas across the country. So Jacob Zuma was a deeply flawed individual like we know. But there were thousands of them being deployed in terms of party policy across the state, agencies of the state, parastatals, state-owned enterprises, who simply were not up to the job, many of them. But secondly, and as Praveen Gordhan told me in our interview, they started seeing individuals identifying opportunities for corruption and graft very early. In fact, in the interview, and I quote him, Praveen Gordhan tells me even before they took over in 1994, they saw that certain individuals were positioning themselves to extract rent from the state. So couple that, John, actually with a growing culture of impunity, or a culture of impunity that started to manifest itself in the 1990s. It was very difficult to start to rein in small instances of corruption, and that grew to massive examples of corruption and graft, and eventually state capture in the 2000s. So it's not something that happened immediately. And speaking to journalists who worked back then, and I quote Tim du Plessis, was an editor of Rapport and Beeld back then, they kind of saw what was happening, but it was very difficult to challenge Nelson Mandela, who had great moral authority, and Thabo Mbeki eventually, whilst the economy was growing. And it's a great point you make. How do you challenge a government when things seem to be working, when the economy seems to be growing? How do you criticize Mandela, who was a global darling, and was a darling in this country as well? So I think the insidious nature of state of KD deployment that was implemented as policy, really came to the fore and delivered its bitter fruits much later than those early years, John, if it makes sense. I might be rambling.
Yeah, I mean, it It does. It seems to me, and you know, one one of the things about South Africa being a country in which so much happens so much of the time, there's always a new scandal. You're just getting to grips with issue A, and issue B comes in and bangs away and attracts all your attention. And reading a book like this reminds you of the continuity of it all, how one thing bleeds into another. And I sort of have the sense that perhaps between 1994 and 2007, the people who were deployed in order to serve the ANC as much, if not more, than serving the people. But there was a reasonable congruence of interest between the people of South Africa and the people of the ANC. And there might have been incompetent people, but people were put into these positions in relatively good faith. And it seemed to me that the big sort of point of change, the big inflection point, is when people began to be put in authority in bad faith, because they were expected to aid state weakening projects. They were expected to aid resource extraction. Does it start with Thabo Mbeki trying to manipulate the National Prosecuting Service so his mate Jackie Salibi doesn't get processed? It's kind of there where the selection process becomes malicious rather than previously potentially benign.
Absolutely right. And I think, I mean, you put your finger on one of the most significant turning points, I think, since 1994, where you've got a sitting head of state actively interfering in a prosecution, actively hindering a prosecution, and for, you know, for very malicious reasons, removing the head of the National Prosecution Service. I mean, it was an outrage then, and it continues to be an outrage today. And I think Mbeki, who was, I mean, you know, John, speaking to some of Mbeki's associates, he was someone that it was utterly determined to show that Africans can run a modern democratic state. That was his single most important driver. You know, that's why he backed GEAR as a macroeconomic policy put forward by a think tank endorsed by Trevor Manuel, but with the tripartite alliance implacably opposed to it. That's why he backed stuff like that, because he believed that he wanted to show the West and the world that they can run a modernizing democratic state. But as part of that, John, which is fascinating, he had to put down the ANC as well. He had to dominate the ANC. He had to put down any sign of revolt inside of the ANC, which inherently is also anti-democratic. And that led to the problems that he later faced. And when those problems arose, when resistance against him started to accelerate, SACP, COSATU, the ANC Youth League, you know, he reverted to type. And what is type? It's central control. It's democratic centralism in ANC parlance. It's the president sitting at the union buildings calling the shots. When an independent-minded national director of public prosecutions simply informs him that he's going to arrest the chief of police, who is a close ally, you know, he couldn't, you know, he was never going to stand for that. But that's anti-democratic, and that's a problem. And that, John, became part of our political culture for the next, I mean, that was 2007-8. That became part of our culture for the next decade, where Jacob Zuma simply rode roughshod over democratic practices and democratic convention. And why were they able to do that? It's because of CADA deployment, because at all layers of government, you had officials, bureaucrats, and CADAs whose loyalty was to the party first and not the constitution and not the national interest. So the Vusi-Pikoli example is one of the best examples I think we can highlight to show how anti-democratic practices started to affect good governance. And it had an enormous effect on, chilling effect on the criminal justice system. You know, John, I don't think the National Prosecuting Authority has ever recovered from that. To this day, the repercussions of the removal of Vusi-Pikoli and the earlier decision by Bulelani Ngcuka not to charge Jacob Zuma it's still an organization that's absolutely fraught with contradictions and internal strife and conflict. And if we don't ensure this, if we don't strengthen institutions of democracy like that, it's not going to work. And KD deployment, John, has had an enormously corrosive effect on all of this.
And then, as you remind us, Jacob Zuma becomes the president, and he continues to manipulate the state. And I mean, I agree with you, as you write. It seems that his prime motivation every day getting up as president of South Africa was to keep himself out of jail, and he was prepared to do anything, wreck anything in order to achieve that. So then this family, this immigrant family from India arrives, the Guptas, they worm themselves into his inner circle, and all of a sudden they kind of become the deployment committee of the ANC, and people in senior positions in Transnet, SAA, at Eskom, Danel, you name it, they are populated by people who, A, owe loyalty to Jacob Zuma, and B, kind of have on their T-shirts Smuts and Gonyama's famous dictum, we didn't join the struggle to stay poor. And they go, I was in the struggle. I have every right to be rich, and it doesn't matter how I get rich. And so we have these profoundly rotten roots of state capture establishing themselves. But you are very hard on Cyril Ramaphosa in the book. I mean, you point out, as he was when he came back into politics as the vice president of the ANC, he became head of the deployment committee. So he must bear a significant amount of responsibility for what then happened. If not under his watch, then he was, you know, he was in charge of a critical area of ANC political structure.
Yes, he was. And look, John, I was hard on the president. And I've received some flack from it, you know, flack from people in the ANC and flack from colleagues that I really respect. But we expected so much more of him, John. We expected so much more of Cyril Ramaphosa. And I remember when he became president in 2018, there was an enormous flurry of excitement, which I shared. And you know, much smarter and more clever colleagues of mine and journalists agreed. You know, he was one of the midwives of the Constitution. You know, he was a, you know, he was in the crucible of the negotiations in the 1990s. He proved himself to be a Democrat. So, you know, we expected so much more of him. But when you actually break it down to where he was and what he said in the period of state capture, you know, it's actually quite enormously disappointing to see that he was an accomplice, John. He was the chairperson of the deployment committee. He spoke in flowery terms in defense of Jacob Zuma right up until the very end. I was at NASREC when Ramaphosa was elected head of state. And from the stage, Ramaphosa thanked Zuma for his extraordinary leadership, for taking the country forward, for distributing, and I'm quoting here, sweeties during NEC meetings. And this to a guy who really brought the country to the absolute brink of destruction. Now, KD deployment happened when Cyril Ramaphosa was the deputy leader of the party, or well, state capture rather, happened when Cyril was deputy leader of the party, when he was deputy head of state for 5 years under Cyril Ramaphosa. And KD deployment was the vehicle which was used to infuse Eskom and Transnet and PRASA and Danel and all of our state departments with Gupta deployees. It went through the deployment committee. Now, Ramaphosa, during the Zondo Commission, tried to distance himself from that. But in the same breath, him and Gwede Mantashe went to great lengths to explain to Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo, as he was known then, why the deployment committee was important, what position it occupied in the ANC, and how senior positions were not awarded unless there was concurrence with the deployment committee. So he can't have his cake and eat it, unfortunately. I remember a meeting, John, that editors had with him in Tainas shortly after he became president. And he spoke about, he only learned about the real ravages of state capture when the Gupta leaks were published, and was it 2017? I forget when it was, 2017. But by then, you know, the media had been reporting on the Guptas and the landing at Waterkloof Air Force Base and buying, trying to buy Kobisi Jonas, the deputy prime minister. Stuff like that had been in the public domain for years. So I do not buy, unfortunately, given the evidence that we've got, that Ramaphosa is innocent in this whole thing. Just last week.
I remember interviewing FW when he wrote his memoir fairly soon after exiting the Government of National Unity. And I put to him the things that I was aware of in the late 80s and early 90s through Freya Weerplat and the Mail and Guardian, the Rand Daily Mail, as to what the forces, the security forces of the state were doing. And I said, you tell me you did not know. You must have known. And he averred he did not know. And Leon Wessels once said to me, we didn't know because we chose not to know. And I think the same reading your book and that part of it, I was reminded of that. The senior ANC people chose not to know. I'm not very attached to it, but I can't entirely throw away the excuse for Ramaphosa in that. In those circumstances, if he had spoken out about state capture and Jacob Zuma and what a disastrous president he was, he would have been removed as deputy president of the ANC, removed as deputy, and he would have lost the ability to step into the chop job and start to fix things. I'm less attached to that defense now than perhaps once I used to be, but I still kind of wonder about that.
Well, look, it's a good point. So John, as far as the technicalities are concerned, and we know what the argument is, and he elaborated on it at length during the Zondo Commission. But the problem with his argument is that Zuma could not have removed him as deputy leader of the party. The only way in which he removed a deputy president of the party is at an extraordinary national conference or an elective conference. And to be able to do that is, in the ANC, almost impossible given the deep divisions that they are. So it would have been next to impossible to remove him as deputy president of the party, even though he could have been fired as deputy head of state. As deputy leader of the party, ensconced at Luthuli House, Ramaphosa could have done an enormous amount to prevent some of the deepest losses that we've suffered under state capture. He could have played an enormous role in directing resources and all, you know, human resources in the right direction. He could have played an enormous role in trying to correct what the deployment committee was doing, because that position was not Zuma's to take away from him. So, look, if someone like Pravin Gordhan, who was the Minister of Finance, who in public over the course of many years, you know, showed enormous commitment, I think, and principled commitment and stoicism in resisting state capture. If he could do it, Ramaphosa could certainly have done. And Gordhan paid for it. He was fired by Zuma unceremoniously one night after the Guptas ANN 7 channel had the news first. And Gordhan went back to Parliament as an MP and provided, you know, some of the most excoriating oversight events that we've seen in Parliament. I'll never forget him having a strong go at Lynn Brown, who was a public enterprises minister, when Gordhan was simply a normal MP. And that made a massive impact and a massive difference in the fight against state capture. Look, I understand the argument, but as I make clear in the book, I don't buy it, John. I don't buy it.
Peter, we're almost out of time. I'd like to ask you whether you think we are heading out of the worst excesses of CADA deployment. We're in the early days of a government of national unity. You and I are recording this on a day when the DA has said that the president's intention to sign the Basic Education Laws Bill into law on what will be tomorrow is a knife to the throat of the GNU. We don't know how seriously the DA takes this. We don't know what the future of the GNU is. But as you and I sit here on this Thursday, what's your sense of CADA deployment? Being thrown out of the window, just hiding in the cupboard and waiting to pop out again?
John, it remains an absolute central pillar of ANC theology and ANC policy. The ANC will not let go of CADA deployment. The party, it's central to the party's DNA, democratic centralism. It's control is what the party stands for. It needs absolute political control, and it needs its deployees in key positions. That's not going to change. It's something that the DA are now coming face to face with. And unfortunately, at News 24, our investigative journalists are confronted with instances of networks of patronage always linked to the governing party popping up everywhere, whether at national, provincial, or municipal level. It won't change. And if it changes, it will be a very, very brave ANC president who tackles that and repeals that as party policy, John.
And Cyril Ramaphosa is, in your view, very definitely not that super brave president. Peter du Toit, thank you very much indeed. Author of the book, The Super Cadres, ANC Misrule in the Age of Deployment, published by Jonathan Ball Publishers. And it is available in all good bookshops and even in a couple of not so good ones. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.